Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we are here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and check us out at our website, www.restaurantguysradio.com, and we're also podcasting on iTunes and Podcast Alley and all those fun internet sites. Well, you can subscribe and have this show sent directly to your computer every day we put one up. Good morning, Mark.
That'd be really fun.
Yeah, that is really fun.
Actually program it so you wake up in the morning to us talking to you.
Yeah, your wife is hard. You're the only one who has to deal with that, is all I have to say. So what's new, Mark?
There's lots of new things.
You know, I was reading the paper, and I was thinking about your travail last week.
To Ohio.
To Ohio with the kids in the car and traveling with kids.
Travail is a good word for it.
And I had an interesting experience, not traveling with kids, but I went to Ireland in the spring with my sister, and we took my 17-year-old niece, who's a charming young woman. But it's interesting traveling with
adopted.
A team. No, genetically related even, but my, you know, that makes no difference, soul in the family. But we traveled with my niece, and it occurred to me, and it always occurs to me when people come to New York or New Jersey and they're like, oh, show us around. And I think, well, you're coming with your kids, right? Or you're sending my nephew to see me. Okay, let's see. What can I do? Cigar bar? No.
You don't want them to show you them around, that's for sure.
Because what do I do with my... And I think, all right, cigar bar? No. Martinis? No.
FAO Schwartz, come on.
I could do the museum, but so it's. I think it's interesting to travel with teens, and I sometimes have to think outside the box because you know I don't have kids, so I don't usually run in that circle.
In what the Chuck E. Cheese circle,
or in the Mars 1211, 1411, whatever that space age restaurant is in New York. But so you know, I have to think hard about it when I travel, and I must say I'm a great uncle, so I come up with cool stuff. But there is now a growing movement of having concierges in hotels for teens.
I think it's kind of neat.
I think that's really true.
Cruise director for your team.
That's exactly right. At the Four Seasons Hotel and Resorts in Chicago, Atlanta, New York, London, Philadelphia, and Toronto, they have these young 20s concierges that are specifically there to help teens not be bored and find something to do.
Well, because they're old enough to go and venture out on their own, but they're not necessarily old enough to want to go to the museum with their parents,
or to go to the museum for a little while, or not to go to dinner at the fancy restaurant. Maybe they don't want to do that anyway. The teens, this is one of Lacey Brentley, one of the teen concierges who's 23. So the teens are sometimes a little intimidated by the regular concierge, said Ms. Brentley, who is one of the concierges. She tries to be more casual, greeting teenagers with. How's it going? Instead of, may I help you? Ms. Brenly said she's surprised that many ask about comedy clubs, jazz clubs, or the best sushi. Their tastes are a lot more mature than I would remember.
I remember spending 12 hours in the Louvre with my dad as a kid.
Oh, God.
And just thinking, oh, golly, please don't show me another statue. Not another painting.
Yeah, but your anything. No offense to your dad, but your dad, from what you tell me about your vacations, was one of those like Chevy Chase vacation guys.
Oh, yeah.
Like Monday, Paris, Tuesday, London, Wednesday, Brussels, back home again.
Sprinting through the Louvre because you had to go through every corridor of the Louvre.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I just hate that. That has nothing to do with being a teenager, my friend.
That was fun.
But
glad
I
did it. How's that?
I think it's great. As long as I didn't have to do it. But I think this idea of the concierge for teenagers is a very interesting idea. I think it's commendable, and I think that. I think that one of the things that's interesting, though, is when you travel with your family, to travel truly together. You know, I don't like television on during a family meal. I know a lot of Americans eat in front of the TV. And unfortunately, the way our schedules work is a lot of Americans don't eat together anymore.
Right.
Our kids, you know, the one guy before soccer practice and then your daughter after ballet class and then you have to get on the...
Or you work in a restaurant and you're not home for dinner frequently.
Yeah, but restaurateurs always had that problem.
Right.
But everybody else has the problem now.
But I love, I mean, there's no TV in the kitchen or the dining room in my house. And we just eat at the table and that's where we share our meals and share our what's either going to happen for the day for breakfast or what happened for the day at dinner.
I think, though, that what the concierges point to, and a couple of the concierges in this article point to, the difference in taste of a teenager. And I think a reason to have a concierge, if you're going to be somewhere for a week or two, you don't want to spend every minute together. And, you know, some 17-year-olds want to just hang around and play video games. Some 17-year-olds
want to go on an adventure.
And some want to do kiddie things, and some want to go, you know, have sushi. And I think that, you know, it's a pretty interesting time, and it's interesting to plan for that kid. And I think it's great to have that.
You know, I realize that the concierge and whatever, whether you're in a hotel or a little bed and breakfast, is such a valuable person because you're traveling in a new city, and maybe you have a Let's Go book or what have you.
But the concierge knows.
But the person sitting at that desk knows what's going on in their city, knows what's going on, certainly within a few blocks of wherever you are, within walking distance, of what's hot, of what just happened, of what's going on, of what show is going.
And the concierge can also work a little magic. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was in Ireland, I stayed with some relatives, but my sister and niece spent a couple of days in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Check this out. They're in Dublin. And like, I wish this happened to me when I was 17. I was going to Seaside Heights hanging out at the boardwalk. So my niece is in Dublin with my sister, and it turns out there's a U2 concert on Saturday night.
Nice.
You know, for the U2, the Irish band, in Ireland, in Dublin, right?
Yeah.
This concert has been sold out forever. Every hotel room in the city is booked up. My sister booked a year in advance. The concierge got my niece tickets to see you two in Dublin. But, you know, the concierges, they have the connection. That's
right.
What they're paid
That's
for.
That's their
and
job.
You could not have gotten a ticket to
you
two.
You're right. Well, it's funny. Even when we go to California, we frequently stay at a place called Brookside Ranch, a woman by the name of Susan Ridley, who has a little property, three-bedroom bed and breakfast right on her vineyard. And Susan knows everything that's happening.
Well, she's connected to the local
in Napa
community.
Valley. She knows everything that's happening. So you want to know about that new restaurant. You want to know about that new vineyard that's just opened. You want to know where the cool tour is. You want her to set you up with that winemaker that only takes appointments.
Well,
it's really a big benefit to have somebody there who's in the know and who's connected.
But one of the things that's very interesting is you hear Mark and I talk about all the time on this show. We talk about being part of the local community, eating locally, going to the local places, supporting local small businesses, and that's what's most exciting in any community. If you if you're traveling just based on some guidebook and only on that, you're really not going to be able to as fully participate in the area as if when you go to a hotel with a great concierge or a small bed and breakfast with somebody who really knows the area.
Right.
They're going to be, the thing about Susan Ridley is she's connected with what's going on in California on a very fundamental way and in a way that you can't be. So, you know, it's sort of like the opposite of what your dad did the way that your dad traveled when you were younger. I'm sure he does it differently now. But to be a tourist is to tour and to, like, see things as you go by. To not really have solid plans set in stone and show up somewhere and maybe have a reservation or two if you have the luxury of doing that and show up in a city and say, okay, concierge, where should I go? What should I see? And have the flexibility to
you gotta
wander
be flexible.
Around.
Like having a framework of what I'm going to be doing while I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if something comes up that's you know, more interesting or more exciting, I'm totally willing to change plans.
You got to wander. And we have a gentleman who's going to join us in the next segment of the show who's an expert on wandering and eating well while you wander. Michael Stern has published Road Food, a guide to some of the best road food in America, and he'll be joining us in just a moment to talk about where to get good eats all across the country. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott from Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick. And today we'd like to welcome as our guest Michael Stern, who together with his wife Jane publishes Road Food, a coast-to-coast guide to 600 of the best barbecue joints, lobster shacks, ice cream parlors, highway diners in the country. Jane and Michael have eaten in every single one of these 600 roadside joints in their book. From New Jersey to California and from Vermont to Texas, People magazine calls their guide an invaluable cross-country culinary guide that should be stashed in every food lover's glove compartment. And you can find out how to order one for your own glove compartment on our website later on today. They've written more than 30 books about America, and their road food column for Gourmet Magazine has won 3 coveted James Beard Awards. They also review books for the New York Times, and they operate roadfood.com, an online interactive community of road food, food warriors, and restaurateurs that's really fabulous. With all that behind us, hi, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
Welcome to the show, Michael.
You sound wonderful.
Don't you sound great?
You're a genius.
I can't believe it, yeah.
All right, Michael, so you have written about a lot of things, and you have a real expertise on food, and of all the foods in the world, why road food?
Oh, it's the best.
Okay.
That's why.
You know that there's a bunch of people out there thinking road food. They're thinking squirrels that you ran over.
I know. That's roadkill. No, the thing, I mean, honestly, I believe, and Jane and I believe, that America's best food is road food. I mean, not that there aren't some great chefs in this country doing fabulous.
We're pretty glad you said that.
Because yeah. There are 7 French chefs listening to this show sharpening their knives right now. Thinking,
I mean, no, there is some great upscale food in this country, much more than there ever used to be. However, you know, we see food, it's almost like folk art. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you really want to get a sense of what this country is like, what people are thinking and doing in their hometowns, I mean, one of the best ways to do it is to sit down in a town cafe or a truck stop or a diner somewhere and eat alongside the locals and eat what the locals eat. I mean, for us, it's more than just food. It's just a real way of tasting this country in every way.
One of the things that I think, you know, it's fun to talk about the highbrow restaurants and the types of restaurants that Francis and I get to eat in a lot and own, it's in reality most of the country.
Most of the time.
Ourselves included,
yep.
Are eating in restaurants more like the ones you write about.
Well, I think so. And, you know, the fact is the really fine dining restaurant is, for most people, a kind of special occasion
sure.
thing.
You
absolutely.
Know, of course.
You know, it's the weekend, it's a big date, it's an anniversary, whatever. Or maybe you're just somebody who loves that kind of food. The kind of places we write about are sort of everyday things. It's like the difference between classical music and folk music, you know. The kind of food we write about at its very best is like it's folk art. Our originality
right.
is not a prized quality of most road food.
You remind me in the way that you write about food, and we'll talk about the food you write about and also the way you write about it. Your guide is very interesting. It's no, you know, Zagat survey with just a quick little, you know, snippet and some scores and points. But the way you write about food and talk about food online and in your columns and in your books, you remind me a lot of, you're kind of in the spirit of Calvin Trillin.
Yeah, well, he's a fellow traveler. I mean, you know, he started a little bit before we did. I mean, he was writing, you know, for The New Yorker about places like Kansas City, Arthur Bryant's, back in the early 70s when we just had the glimmer of an idea that this country needed a book called Road Food. Because, you know, back, it's hard to remember, in fact, you know, some 30 years ago how, I don't want to say backward, but how less interest there was in food at every level this country.
You know, Calvin Trillin used to write about when he would, you know, he wrote about a lot of things, but everyone knew that he was a food writer and used to write about great food in America. And he has, in a book called The Tummy Trilogy, I think it was, he writes about, he said, so I would always show up in some small town in the Midwest and the mayor or somebody of importance would meet me at the airport and say, oh, Mr. Trillin, we're so glad you're here. We have a fabulous French restaurant in town.
Right.
And he was always tempted to respond, no, you don't.
Yeah, exactly. And I also remember his comment about how a lot of these restaurants boasted that they served continental cuisine, and he often wondered which continent it was Antarctica, because so much of it started frozen.
Right,
know?
Right.
That's good.
Well, and then he would, of course, try and ditch that local person trying to steer him to the French restaurant and go find a local barbecue joint. Is that your philosophy as well?
Without a doubt. And one of the great things about what has happened over the last 2 or 3 decades is that I think more and more people are recognizing that their local barbecue parlor, catfish place, lobster roll shack, you know, whatever it might be, is really worthwhile.
Right,
and of
special.
Interest.
Special, you know, special started, in its own way.
It is special in its own way. And in some ways, you know, I think a lot of people, for example, they grow up in a particular town or region and are so accustomed to whatever their local specialty is. You know, I grew up in Chicago and I grew accustomed to great Italian beef sandwiches, which is a real Chicago thing. You don't find it anywhere else. It was only when I moved away from Chicago that I realized, man, this is a local specialty, because you kind of take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you find, though, that the local specialties are under assault as, you know, everyone on television starts to lose their accent and we all start to eat in Olive Garden wherever we are in the country?
Oh, I know. Well, that's a con. You know, I'll tell you, you can get really depressed when you think about the onslaught of the big chains. However, I have to say that when Jane and I put together the first edition of Road Food back in the 70s, we honestly believed we were documenting the end of an era, that by the year 2000, there would only be the really upscale restaurants for people with a lot of money and good taste and the chains.
Right, and Taco Bell.
But that really hasn't happened. Well, Jane and I have seen a lot of great restaurants get kind of muscled out of business. Mm-hmm. You know, great mom and pop restaurants get muscled out because, you know, a TGIF or whatever moves into town. But the fact is that because we Americans have become more appreciative of our local cuisine, I think a lot of it is holding on where it might not have held on 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Do you think it's actually swinging back the other way, or do you think that McDonald's and those places are continuing to take deeper roots?
Well, there's no stopping the franchises. Yeah. I mean, they've got the money, they've got the muscle. However, I've seen a lot of examples. You know, I haven't taken a survey, but I've seen a lot of examples of wonderful, one-of-a-kind local restaurants actually getting passed on to a new generation.
That's amazing. That's amazing, and that's something that we as restaurant owners and consultants for small restaurants love to see. We're here talking with author Michael Stern, and we're talking about his book Road Food, and we'll be talking more about where you can get great road food across the country and right here in New Jersey in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're here talking with Michael Stern, who together with his wife Jane publishes Road Food and is a noted author on road food in America. Hi again, Michael.
Hey, how you doing?
You were talking just before the break about you're seeing restaurants that you thought mom and pops, and you know, one of the things we talk about in Jersey all the time is I sat on the board of directors for the New Jersey Restaurant Association for many years. And whenever we would get involved in the National Restaurant Association, because there's an affiliation between the state associations and the national, New Jersey Restaurant Association was always these little mom and pops dominated the board and dominated our membership. But in most other states, it was McDonald's, Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Boston, you know, Let Us Entertain You, Be Our Guest, these big, big groups. Is the mom and pop more found in the Northeast, or where do we find more mom and pops? Where do we find more chains?
Well, that's an interesting question because, in fact, you know, road food. Some people will complain about our book because we might have like 30 restaurants listed in New Jersey and 3 in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's great road food is really a reflection of the population, and in places like the Northeast, you know, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, even up into Maine, or places like the Gulf Coast, you know, the Deep South, New Orleans, you find these kind of really heterogeneous populations that lend themselves to just great food. You know, some of those kind of Italian-American, you know, French-American, whatever, slash American cuisines, and as well as cuisines that have developed here indigenously, places where there are strong concentrations of population, you find tons of excellent road food.
Well, there are 37 people in South Dakota. I mean, how many restaurants can they support?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense for, you know, a great, wonderful mom-and-pop restaurant to exist in every little town in South Dakota. However, you know, in New Jersey or southern Louisiana, for us to find great road food, it's like, you know, shooting fish in a barrel.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, it's funny. I traveled across... I have a motorcycle, and sometimes I'll head out Midwest, and I like to ride on the blue highways. And I didn't have your book the last time I did it, and so I'll have to have your book in my saddlebags next time I go. But I would often find myself traveling in like the West Virginia area and like border the Midwest and the South.
I just went through West Virginia last week.
And boy, is your book necessary, because out there it's not shooting fish in a barrel.
It's like Waffle House, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, Burger King.
There's actually, the worst abomination is held in the name of this chain. The Eaton Park.
Oh, great.
Have you ever heard of the Eaton Park?
No, I haven't.
Didn't walk inside, but I thought, that is just where we're going.
But literally, I was going through West Virginia just last week.
Almost
like I said,
heaven.
And literally every exit has a McDonald's.
There's nothing to eat. Well, see, West Virginia is a tricky one because some of the great specialties in West Virginia, the road food type specialties, are oddly enough not found in restaurants. They're found in the most unlikely, like convenience stores
right.
and bakeries.
You know, it's funny that you say that because we stopped in a town because the baby was screaming, stopped in a little town, and I refused to go to one of the chains, and so we went to one of these, what looked like a little convenience store place, and they were serving delicious fried chicken. And, you know, you could buy a bottle of water for the road or whatever, but it had little tables inside of it. Really unique place,
yeah,
I thought.
Yeah, well, that's one of the tricks of road food in some places is that it's not served in what you would imagine, you know, the classical small-town cafe with the little calico curtains. I mean, in West Virginia, for example, one of the great specialties there that we didn't know about this for years,
mm-hmm.
because we just didn't know to look for it, is what they call the pepperoni roll.
And we're going to find more about the pepperoni roll when we come back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and you can also reach us on the web at restaurantguysradio.com or one of those fancy podcasting places like iTunes or Podcast Alley. Today, we're talking to Michael Stern. Together with his wife, Jane, he publishes Road Food, a coast-to-coast guide to 600 of the best barbecue joints, lobster shacks, ice cream parlors, and highway diners in the country. They've written more than 30 books about America, and their Road Food column for Gourmet magazine has won three coveted James Beard Awards. They also review books for the New York Times, and they operate roadfood.com. Welcome back, Michael.
Hey, guys.
Before the news, you were talking to us about a specialty that is known, that West Virginia is known for.
Yes, it's known primarily only to West Virginians who live there because it hasn't traveled far. It's called the pepperoni roll, which is something that I think we in the Northeast, knowing great Italian food like we do, can appreciate. It was actually invented back in the 1920s at a local bakery as a food that miners could take into the mines with them easily, sort of like the pasty up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. What it is like a pizza-like dough wrapped around pepperoni sticks that is then baked. And what happens, it's really delicious, is that the pepperoni sticks have enough oil in them that the oil kind of saturates the dough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're portable. They're absolutely delicious.
Sounds horrible for you and spectacular.
Well, what food isn't? You know? I mean, what worthwhile food isn't?
Now, how do you eat this? Do you like eat it like a lollipop or do you slice it and eat it?
No, well, it's interesting. The convenience stores that serve it and bakeries, you just eat it like a lollipop, you know, just chow down on it like you would a roll that happens to have this thing inside. There are a few places that serve it on a plate topped with sauce. So it becomes almost like what we might call a calzone, you know?
That's a meat stick.
Yeah.
It's just a meat stick. How glorious is that?
Yeah, meat and bread, you know, with some sauce on it. I'm happy.
So what other regional specialties are? Let's start with the Northeast. What other regional specialties are there?
Well, for example, you know, if you're traveling along the coast of Maine, you want a lobster roll.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we just did that. Actually, I'm saying that because we just did it a few weeks ago. And boy, the lobster rolls you get at places like Red's Eats in Wiscasset or the Clam Shack in Kennebunkport are so spectacularly good. I mean, it's the meat more than the meat from a whole 1 pound lobster piled into a bun and drizzled with melted butter. That's all. What's better than that?
Now, what more do you need?
Now, let me ask you, when you find places that are sort of remote from the region or some places that do the weak imitation, what do they do wrong? Let's talk about the lobster roll.
Or the Philly cheesesteak, or, yeah.
Well, you know, there are all kinds of things they can do wrong. I mean, the thing about a great lobster roll is that meat has been picked out of the lobster within minutes of it being put in the bun.
As opposed to coming in a frozen bag to Bennigan's.
We once went to a restaurant in northern Michigan, and they had some lobster dish on the menu, and we thought, you know, Michigan is not the place you're going to order a lobster.
Right.
But we had to ask. We asked the waitress. We said, "Is this lobster fresh?" And the waitress said, "Oh yes, I just saw the chef open the can."
That's great. And that's when you said, you know what? My wife is feeling ill. Can we have a chat? You know what? That brings me to, like, you know, corporate agribusiness has all these ways to fool you into thinking you're eating something that you're not, or you're not eating something that you are. My favorite line is, if you go into the supermarket aisles, you'll see fresh frozen.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, it means that it was fresh when they froze it, but it's not anymore. As opposed to the people who let things rot.
As opposed to spoiled frozen, exactly.
Yeah, that's, Everything was fresh once, everybody. You know, it's a broken clock, right, twice a day. Well, one of our favorite regional American foods that you write about pretty widely in your book is barbecue. I think that's one of the most fascinating, uniquely American foods. Can you talk to us about barbecue?
Yeah, well, I mean, we could have done an entire book devoted only to barbecue.
I'll bet you will sometime.
Ourselves, just because there are so many different regional variations of barbecue. Mm-hmm. You know, the basic one, of course, being, you know, in Texas you get beef, in the Carolinas you get pork, but then in, you know, western Kentucky you get mutton.
Right.
And what kind of wood is it smoked over, and mm-hmm. does it have sauce? And if it does have sauce, what kind of sauce? And is it a mustard sauce? Is it tomato sauce? Is it a vinegar sauce? Is it just in a kind of a juice from the meat? You know, the varieties are endless, not to mention all the requisite side dishes in certain areas. You know, like in some places it's hush puppies. In other places it's just a stack of Sunbeam white bread.
Does anybody anywhere make good bread that goes with barbecue? That's always my disappointment.
Well, I've had barbecue served on excellent rolls. And let me tell you, it was extremely confusing to my palate. In some ways, I have come to believe that bad bread, it's there to sop up sauce. And if it has a taste and texture of its own, it's confused.
Gets in the
but
way.
You're right. I mean, good, excellent barbecue and excellent bread are two things that are seldom, if ever, found together on a plate.
I think that one of the things that lends barbecue to being so regionally different and people putting so much heart and soul into it is it takes so long. Great barbecue takes 12 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours sometimes to create. So people are putting their heart and soul into barbecue, and which I think in turn, You have people taking a little more care to make it.
You're absolutely right. Barbecue requires a kind of devotion that, by definition, is going to create something special. It's not, unless you use that everybody's favorite liquid smoke to get that flavor. It does take time. And you know, Jane and I, in fact, developed a whole theory of it's the pigs plus Jesus theory of barbecue, that when you're in the Deep South, if you go into a barbecue parlor and see a lot of religious iconography on the wall, chances are very good the barbecue is going to be excellent. Because there's a similarity, and I'm not trying to be smart about it, there's a real similarity between devotion to one's faith and devotion to barbecue. It takes time.
Barbecue is a faith, man.
It is. Yeah, there you go.
You know, one of the things that's very interesting about barbecue is we talk all the time about how America, at least in a lot of parts of America, are getting increasingly good taste. And while I don't really care for, you know, reality shows or cook-off shows on television or Iron Chef things, I think they're kind of stupid in a way, but the rise of the celebrity chef and the TV food channel and all the cooking shows on TV, I think is lending to America having increasingly good taste. And one of the areas that people have always had good taste and been really passionate about what they like and what they don't, what people get into arguments about, is barbecue.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you're right. And that's a rarity. I mean, because I think you're absolutely on the ball when you say that. I mean, I think that I don't think it's even going too far to say that we've had a kind of culinary renaissance in this country over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
I don't think that's an exaggeration at all.
I agree.
I mean, because when you think what it was like, I mean, I'm old enough to remember what it was like in the early 70s. I mean, it was a sad scene in terms of finding good food at any level, you know.
Uh-huh.
It was tough. And I think there is a renaissance, but you're right. There are some foods, I mean, I think barbecue is one, chili is another one. You could start a civil war.
Well, isn't that what the Civil War was started over?
Yeah, could be.
Now you have 600 restaurants in your guide. You've eaten at each of these restaurants?
Well, we've eaten at probably 6,000 to find those 600. I mean,
you're a busy guy.
You must be very fat.
These are the 600 of the restaurants that we like best. And, you know, to find one that's worth recommending, you've got to eat in at least a handful of ones that are maybe just okay or worse.
Do you spend all your time on the road?
About half, maybe.
And you just go from place to place?
And we eat, yes.
And
we
will
are
you do
blessed
like,
with excellent appetite.
Will
That's
you do two lunches a day? Will you do two lunches a day?
Two? No, I mean, we will on a really good day, and if we're in a place that is road food rich, we might go into 10, 12 restaurants.
Oh, my God.
Which isn't to say we're going to have 10 or 12 full meals, you know,
right.
because we have to be able to order something, and if it tastes only mediocre, just, you know, appetite.
Push it aside.
Precious.
We're talking with Michael Stern. We're talking about his book, Road Food, and we'll be talking with him more about how he writes and about what's going on in New Jersey and New York in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, and today our guest is Michael Stern, who's written Road Food about road food throughout America. He also operates roadfood.com. And listen, People Magazine calls this guide an invaluable cross-country culinary guide that should be stashed in every food lover's glove compartment. And that means you out there, everybody. So you can find his book, more about his book at roadfood.com, or you can find out more about him through us at www.restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, Michael.
Hey, guys.
Your book, I alluded to earlier, that it's not a Zagat survey. It doesn't say, visit this place, 26 points, people say, have the ham. You know, it's you write little stories about each of these restaurants, really. And what do you do that's differently? How would you classify your unique way of reviewing these places?
Well, as I said earlier, for Jane and me, what we're looking for is not only delicious food, but an experience. That sings of its place and region. So that means we want to know about how the food is presented to you, how you get it. You know, some places you stand at the counter and you take a number. Mm-hmm. Other places it's dished out by a rude waitress. You know, whatever, you know, the whole experience of getting the food is important to us, including, you know, accents. So how do the people speak? What's their slang for a particular kind of food? So when we write about a restaurant, it's really crucial for us to not just say, here's what you get on a plate, but here's what's going to happen when you walk in the door, or maybe even when you come into this town.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and that's what we're trying to capture when we write about these places.
So do you only write about the places that make it to your column or to your book? So those are places that you're recommending. You've already weeded out the ones that you don't recommend.
Yeah, it's our feeling that nobody needs, and in fact, nobody would buy a book that was a guide to all the places we really didn't like eating at.
Oh, you know, places to avoid?
We traveled around the country.
I actually might buy a book of places to avoid.
Although I think you could do a short book of very funny anti-reviews or a little appendix at the back of how the horrible places you've been. Have you had any like truly comical experiences of just, oh my God, get me out of here?
Yeah. Oh yeah. We have had some. You know, really hideous food. Some of it simply because, you know, the cook or chef made some terrible mistakes. I mean, I remember an omelet that we got in Oklahoma once that was really the texture of a Michelin tire. I think, you know, stuff like that happens all the time. But the really funny stuff is what happens when what we are served is exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Like, give us an example.
Well, for example, chitlins steamed in vinegar.
Oh,
Now, you know, a fried chitlin is, you know, that I can take or leave. Chitlins steamed in vinegar. Imagine the aroma of this dish. It's down in Southern Virginia. This is a favorite in a lot of restaurants.
Okay, you talked about the pepperoni roll. I was hungry. You've cured that problem.
Have you ever had snoot?
Oh, yeah. Now, snoot's pretty good.
Oh, come on.
No, snoot is good.
I'm returning your book right now.
In St. Louis, there's a place called C&K Barbecue in St. Louis, Missouri, where we avoided snoots for many years. Finally, we decided we'd be brave, we'd order them, and I expected like a pig snout on a plate.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it's not. It's like strips of meat. It's sort of like Cucci Fritos.
It's strips of meat taken from the pig snout on the plate.
Yeah.
You don't deny this.
But you know what's worse than snoots? I mean, if snoots are bad, I thought, well, since I enjoyed snoots a little bit, maybe I should order pig ear, which was also on the menu.
Yeah.
What I got was literally one pig ear.
Yeah, that's how they're served.
Two pieces of bread.
They're really served that way. They really actually serve you pig ear.
Okay, I'll take the silk purse, everybody. We'll leave the pigs here. You know, it's funny. We did a show from the New York, the Big Apple Barbecue Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And we interviewed a woman who served me snoot for the first time. And I got her on the radio, and I swear she said to me, I'm going to win a James Beard Award for this.
She was great.
She explained it to me, and I was sort of incredulous as to what it was. It was the posterior of the nose of the – and I said, and you eat that? And she said, we serve it all, from the rooter to the tooter. I thought, I neither want the rooter nor the tooter. I'll just take the things in the middle.
I would like the middle, please.
Call me a snob if you want. So what about New Jersey, man? You've written about New Jersey, and everything in New Jersey you write about is a hot dog.
Well, not entirely. We do write about these spectacular hero sandwiches down at the White House.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that, you know, there are a lot of good places to get such sandwiches in the Delaware Valley, but I really still think that the best on earth are there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people who think they've eaten one because they had one in New York City or in Hartford
have no
idea what they're talking
about. You know, it's true.
I mean, there are people in this state who drive to Atlantic City, to gamble, and then they get a...
they drown their sorrows.
Exactly.
Literally, there's no way I'm leaving Atlantic City without stopping. Not a chance.
No, it's one of the greats.
You know, well, Mark's originally from Nutley, which is in Essex County, New Jersey, which is the county that Newark is in, and I'm originally from Orange. And so all of your, like, Newark hot dog... places that you recommend?
Oh, yeah.
You really hit the nail on the head there.
Well, that's one of those local specialties that I think locals take for granted.
Oh,
and
no.
We didn't even know about them ourselves until many years ago. Martha Stewart told us, you know, as a native.
Really? Oh, she's from Nutley.
She was the one who recommended Rutt's Hut to us.
Let me tell you, if you're from that region.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, Rutt's Hut is an icon. Yeah.
Mark and I live 45 minutes away from there when we're down here in New Brunswick, and we would drive up to North Jersey for a hot dog. And people say, you're driving 45 minutes for a hot dog? You don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
The problem with Rutt's Hut, though, was it closes at like 11 or 12 o'clock. And the time you really want a Rutt's hot dog is about 1 a.m., 2 a.m.
That's a long night. It's the killer cure method of hot dog eating. Right?
You know what else I love about your book? You really capture Rutt's Hut, which is this dive on 46 where it's all stainless steel, and the guy yells into a microphone to the short order cook to make you your fried hot dog.
Yeah.
And you capture the lingo, which I go at Rutt's. You cite where they order twins all the way, which is two hot dogs with mustard and relish.
Yeah.
My favorite thing when I go there to order is I order two hot dogs and an orange soda. Because you know what the short order cook slang lingo for that is?
No.
Two rippers and a howdy.
A howdy.
Orange
howdy
soda.
Howdy duty.
Howdy duty, orange hair, orange soda.
Yeah, it took me about a year and a half.
I never knew this.
Took me about a year and a half to figure out what a howdy was.
I don't even like orange soda. I just like hearing them say that in the microphone.
Well, see, that's my point, is that the whole experience of eating there, I mean, it's part of why that hot dog is so delicious.
You got it. Listen, we're talking with Michael Stern. He's the author of Road Food, and he also hosts roadfood.com, where you can go online to find out where the best places to get road food wherever you're traveling in America is. And we're going to talk about his website in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 14:50. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 14:50 WCTC.
You're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we have with us Michael Stern, who has recently written a book called Road Food and writes for Gourmet Magazine. But, Michael, what we want to talk to you a little bit now is your website, roadfood.com, which is really a nice interactive site where people can get answers to a lot of questions and lots of places where they can go and enter chat rooms and discuss food issues.
Well, I tell you, it kind of grew... It's one of those things we started several years ago. I mean, I don't have the expertise to do it, but a good road food fan named Stephen Rushmore, who's a computer expert, started it, and it's grown tremendously. We have these forums for not only people who like to eat in restaurants, but for restaurateurs as well.
I saw the restaurant professionals section. It was very good.
Yeah, and what I love about it is that, you know, as good as Jane and my appetites are, we can't eat everything all the time, but roadfood.com has a way for, you know, people who use the site can submit their own reviews of places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you edit those at all and say, oh, no, that's crap, I'm not putting that up there?
We have somebody who does that, who's like a real road food connoisseur, who not only edits them, but figures out which ones are written by the restaurant owner themselves. You know? So they are kind of screened, you know. I mean, we don't want to post just junk, but I mean, I just think it's wonderful that it's open to appetites all over the country,
right?
To you know, to post reviews of places that real road food fans ought to know about.
Well, and you have on the website, you know, you only list six or seven places for New Jersey, for example, in your book, which you visited personally, but there are 18 places listed on your website, and it's really amazing the detail you get. If you click on these places' names, like if you click on Rutt's Hut, you get a picture of Rutt's Hut, you get a sample menu from Rutt's Hut.
Yeah.
Very
okay,
interesting
hold on,
stuff.
Hold on.
Right.
Rutt's Hut doesn't really have a menu.
It's very short. It's very, very short.
Well, don't they have that room where you can actually go and sit down?
They actually do have a sit-down meal? Place, but nobody I know has ever actually been in that room.
It looks interesting. Yeah.
Hey, I have to make a plug for being a Jersey guy. Right across from Jimmy Buff's in West Orange, two blocks away, there's a place called the Star Tavern for pizza.
Ooh.
Best pizza in New Jersey.
Yeah, oh, it is
Jersey
not.
Jersey has some excellent pizza. Too.
Yeah, there's no pizza in your book on Jersey.
I know. We have to go to Lorenzo's in Newark. People have been killing us
it's
not
good.
Having done that.
I say Star Tavern. And it's in Orange, right across the West Orange border. It's two blocks from Jimmy Buff's.
Off the air, we'll give you some more suggestions.
Okay.
Hey, we want to thank you for taking the time to join us, Michael.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Michael.
And we're going to link you up to our website so people can find you through us. And your book is just invaluable. It's really great. And I'm going to stick it in my saddlebags for the next time I go on a little motorcycle.
It's in my glove
run.
Box as we speak.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Take care, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Thanks. What an interesting fellow. What a great book. Michael Stern. Who publishes Road Food and roadfood.com, writes for Gourmet Magazine. And he writes about other stuff, too. It's not just about food. He's writing 30 books about America in general.
But the reality is every single one of us spends time on the road, driving from place to place, and the choices, if you don't have a resource like this, are fast food or take a chance on some place that you've never heard of.
And there's fast food that you can get that's actually real. I mean, we have Tasty Subs. Tasty Subs, the two different towns are in. What are the two towns?
One's in Edison, one's up in like South Brunswick.
That's a sub shop that locally is really good, and it's not owned by a corporation. It's owned by a guy.
Right. Jersey Subs in New Brunswick.
Jersey Subs in New Brunswick is a great place if you're in downtown New Brunswick to go. And you know, I would always rather go to a place that's owned by an individual and take my chances.
Well, because generally they have a little bit more invested in it.
Well, I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450 times 12 noon.